This is London calling North America. The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter by MacDonald Hastings. This week, Mr. Hastings is talking to you from Edinburgh.
This is MacDonald Hastings talking to you. Not from London, but from Edinburgh. This week, I'm in the capital of Scotland. And although my voice is coming to you from 5,000 miles away, as it comes from Scotland, I can believe that to many of you, I'm talking very near your hearts. If you haven't got Scots blood in your veins yourself, I'm sure you've got a neighbour who has. Who hasn't? And you'll know that whenever the word Scotland is mentioned, wherever you may be in the English-speaking world, there'll be somebody called Mac to overhear it and to wipe a misty tear from his eye. The northern hills of this island of Britain, with their bare population of 4.5 million souls, have somehow contrived to spread their suns all over the earth. And wherever you go, you'll meet the sandy-haired, blue-eyed, porky-tempered Scot. He's the man in charge of the engine room on almost any ship you sail in. He's the editor of the local paper in Red Horse Gap. He runs the trading store at the edge of beyond. And wherever you find him, the Scot clings to his memories and his customs, even the accents of his mother country, against the background of almost any other place in the world. Not even the Irishman, and that's saying something, not even the Irishman is more obstinate in his loyalties and more resistant to change in his racial characteristics than the exiled Scot. I can't help remembering one typical example now. A wanderer on the face of the earth, if ever there was one, named Murdo MacDonald. Mac had worked his passage in ship's engine rooms all over the seven seas. From his cuttings book, I should guess that he'd worked as a newspaper man in every state of America and half across Canada, too. He'd been away from Scotland so long that when he went back to the Highlands for a visit, the cold winds and the misty rain put him to bed with a chill in a week. And yet, Scotland kept such a sentimental grip on him that he couldn't bear to shake hands with a stranger without letting the stranger know immediately, not only that he was a Scot, but that he was born in the island of Skye. In fact, Mac's little speech about his origins was so certain in coming out that, cruelly, we used to bet on it. And whenever he was introduced to somebody, we'd crowd round, watches in hand, to see when he was going to blow out his chest and begin, "I was born in the island of Skye." And he usually did it within the specified 3 minutes of shaking hands. I can't remember that Mac ever let us down. He's editing a paper now, I think, in South Africa, and I'm sure he's still telling everybody he meets, "I was born in the island of Skye," and then reciting a poetic little piece about the crofter's cottage where he came from, the wild hills, the red deer, the leaping salmon. Poor Mac. He went down to the sea from the peaty-coloured Highland River where he was born, like a salmon himself. And like a Scottish salmon, his instincts are telling him all the time to go back. Somehow he can't find the way. Sounds absurd, but it isn't. If you think about it, you'll see there's a very good reason for this romantic yearning which every Scot has for his native hills. Wherever in the world you find him, however remote the link, there's a reason for this combination of intense nationalism and the urge, which so many Scots have too, to leave their own country and settle elsewhere. It's an economic reason. Materially, Scotland is a poor country. The larger part of it consists of barren hills and wild, untamable moorland. Thousands of square miles of it aren't worth ploughing. The pasture is sparse, and the climate in winter so fierce that it's only suitable for hill sheep and the hardy breeds of native cattle. Apart from the great city of Glasgow and the shipbuilding on the Clyde, industry has not been developed. In the north, in the Highlands, Virtually the only living is the subsistence that the crofters can make out of the thin envelope of fertile land. So, for 200 years at least, Scots have been forced to drift south in search of a fortune or settle overseas. But the pull one way of economic necessity has increased the pull the other way of national survival. And so you find a greater national pride, a greater nurturing of tradition in Scotland and among Scottish people than perhaps in any other race. The old family clans, for instance, which ceased long ago to have any social significance, the old clans still preserve their memory, still wear the tartan and the kilt. In the Highlands, they still keep green the memory of the 45, when some of the clans rose under Prince Charles Edward in a last attempt to put the Stuarts on the British throne again. They still cling to family customs and traditions. There's one family I know who, to commemorate some ancient blood feud, still eat their porridge with salt and not sugar, because that's the Scottish way. They still eat their breakfast porridge standing up. And there's a house on the border called Traquair, where the entrance gates haven't been opened for 200 years. The story is that they won't be opened again till a Stuart and a Catholic reign on the throne of Britain. And I remember that when King George V visited Traquair, the laird came out to tell him about the curse. King George, smiling all over his face, politely agreed to make his entrance by the back door. Politically, it means nothing at all. It simply was an example of how carefully in Scotland tradition is preserved. I must tell you a story about Traquair. It's the oldest inhabited house in the British Isles, and probably very nearly in the world. There are Saxon wall paintings on it, and the Elizabethan wing is actually called the New Wing. King Duncan of Macbeth fame, remember him? King Duncan issued the charter incorporating the city of Glasgow from this very house. Well, the story is that it wasn't until the 1920s that the first bathroom was put into this house, much against the old laird's wishes, but under pressure from the younger generation. Well, when they went to put the pipes in, a lot of the old ceiling came down, and with it a heap of human bones and ancient weapons. Everybody was very excited, wondering how all the bones got there and why. But the old laird was furious and insisted on the whole lot being plastered back into the ceiling with the comment, whoever put the bodies there had a very good reason for putting them there. That was that. I remember that in the same house, it was nothing to open a bureau drawer and find old account books or letters dated 14 or 15 something. Nothing was ever moved or changed from one generation to another. Of course, that attitude is largely confined to the Highlands. I mean, Edinburgh, where I am now, and the great city of Glasgow in the lowlands of Scotland, they move with the times. But the problem is the Highlands, and the resistance which the Highlanders have always shown to change. Perhaps they're right. Perhaps the hills are best preserved as great playgrounds, which is what they are now. The chief industry of the Highlands now is sport. Grouse shooting, deer stalking, salmon fishing, providing hunting for rich men from all over the world. And there's a case to keep it so. The shooting of the native red grouse in Scotland and the stalking of the native red deer provide sports of a character you can get nowhere else. But the trouble is that the needs of sport are antagonistic to the Highlands' development. For instance, at this moment, there's a great controversy going on to decide whether or not to go ahead with a great power scheme at Loch Ness for the electrification of the Highlands. The people who want to keep the Highlands for their sport oppose the scheme because it would mean the disturbance of the wildlife in the area. And others of them say that the hydroelectric scheme would spoil the natural beauty of the hills. At the same time, there's a crying need for modern amenities. And personally, my guess is that sooner or later, the power scheme will go through. and the monster, which is said to inhabit the depths of Loch Ness, will get a shock. But it'll arouse bitter feelings among people who still nurture what's called the Highland tradition. And I've no doubt there'll be misty eyes, too, when they hear about it among exiled Scots all over the world, and people who aren't Scots, too, because Scotland has a way of enamouring almost everybody who meets her. Edinburgh, for instance, was the G.I. Joe's favourite city. They came here in their thousands, though quite few about now. And if you know Edinburgh, that isn't surprising. Edinburgh is one of the few cities in Europe, the oldest city in Europe anyhow, built on the block system of American cities. But it isn't new. The planned rebuilding of Edinburgh was carried out in Georgian times, in the heyday of British architecture. And the result? Well, it's one of the most beautiful cities of the world. The buildings are all made of the same soft grey stone and in the same architectural style. Crescents of terraced houses all fit in to a single plan. Wide streets run at right angles to each other, and the whole scheme is linked to one magnificent avenue called Prince's Street, which runs through the centre of the city. On one side, Prince's Street is lined with gardens. On the other, shops. At each end are the two main railroad stations, and beyond you look out onto the blue, misty hills. Whenever I stand in Prince's Street, I always recall the memory of the great painter James Pride. James Pride was one of a whole coterie of brilliant writers and artists which Edinburgh produced at the beginning of this century. And as Scotsmen always have to do, Pride went to London to make fame and fortune. As artists do, he had a bad, poverty-stricken time, but finally he made his name, and one of his pictures was bought by John Junius Morgan for, I think, about $5,000. Pride, when he got the money, stayed in London just long enough to cash the cheque. Then he caught the first train to Edinburgh, bought himself a pair of tartan socks, so he told me anyhow, and lived on Prince's Street until the last shilling was gone. Then he came back to London to try and make some more money. And when he came back, all he said was that if he was a millionaire like John Junius Morgan, he wouldn't buy pictures, he'd buy Edinburgh and take that home to America instead. And now, this is MacDonald Hastings, signing off. Till next week.
We've been listening to a recording of London Letter by MacDonald Hastings, presented from London by the BBC.